Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI appeals to the international community to bring assistance to the people of Madagascar who have been hit by a devastating storm. The faith-based organisation Release International, that gives voice to persecuted Christians across the globe, launches an appeal for victims of extremist attacks in Nigeria. And the world's only NGO with a focus on providing assistance and advocacy to older people shines the light on older women, who are the invisible backbone of communities, families and food production in developing countries. Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday launched an appeal for the people of Madagascar who are suffering the effects of a devastating storm. Speaking to the pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square for the Angelus prayer, the Pope urged the intervention of the international community in bringing assistance to the victims. And as Chris Wells reports, he told the faithful that violence never serves humanity.
La violenza non serve mai all'umanità, ma la disumanizza.
Violence never serves humanity. It only dehumanizes. This was the Pope's message at Sunday's Angelus address as he commented upon the gospel passage of the purification of the temple in front of several thousand pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square. He described our Lord's action of driving the money changers from the temple as a prophetic action. Indeed, he said, the prophets, in the name of God, often denounced abuses, and they sometimes did so with symbolic gestures.
In realtà, è impossibile interpretare Gesù come violento.
It is impossible to describe Jesus as violent, the Pope said, because violence is contrary to the kingdom of God. It is a tool of the Antichrist. After the Angelus, the Holy Father launched an appeal for the people of Madagascar, hit by a devastating tropical storm.
Cari fratelli e sorelle, il mio pensiero va anzitutto alle care popolazioni del Madagascar.
My thoughts go first to the dear people of Madagascar, which have been recently hit by severe natural disasters, with serious damage to people, buildings, and crops. He said, while I assure the victims and the families of those so greatly tried of my prayers, I hope for and encourage the generous assistance of the international community. Finally, Pope Benedict greeted pilgrims from around the world, including those from English-speaking countries.
In today's gospel, Jesus foretells his resurrection and points to the temple which is his body, the church. May our meditation on this mystery deepen our union with the Lord and His Church. Upon all of you and invoke God's blessings.
Thanks there to Christopher Wells for that report. The faith-based organisation Release International has launched an emergency appeal for victims of extremist attacks in Nigeria. So far, over 100 Christians have been killed this year in violence perpetrated by the extremist Islamic group Boko Haram in northern and central Nigerian regions. Thousands of Christians who have fled their homes as a result of the recent militant atrocities have been helped by local churches and by the authorities. But the situation remains desperate and funds are still needed to provide vital support. I spoke to Matt Constant, Communications Manager at Release International, about the current appeal and about the work of the organisation itself.
We're a charity that's been going more than 40 years now, and our basic ethos is to support and serve persecuted Christians around the world. We work in probably more than 30 countries, supporting church leaders, but especially Christian prisoners and their families. We also supply literature, Bibles, and work for justice as well.
Well, you must have a lot of work to do because the news is full of news about the situation of persecuted Christians and others around the world. I see on your front page you have a new campaign for the situation in Nigeria. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, well, the situation in Nigeria has been deteriorating over the last few months. Islamist extremists, you may have heard of a group called Boko Haram, have been carrying out attacks on various institutions in central and northern Nigeria. And caught up in all this are Christians and churches. Over the last few months, many Christians have been either killed or have lost loved ones in the violence. So we're very concerned that the violence is increasing, really, and Christians are becoming more and more vulnerable to this. So what we're trying to do is, this month in March, is organise a month of prayer for Nigerian Christians for the situation in that country, just that there would be an end to this violence. And as part of that, we would also ask people to write to the Nigerian authorities, just expressing their concern and urging them to do everything that they possibly can to tackle this rise of extremism in Nigeria. Some Christian leaders believe that there is some attempt to try and divide the country in two, into a Sharia-based northern state and then a more Christian southern state. So we would really ask people to pray that this doesn't happen and that there would be peace restored in Nigeria as a whole.
I see that there is also a click the donate button, and you mentioned that any kind of donation will in fact go in providing basic necessities for refugees and things like that.
Yes, one of the big concerns is that Christians who have obviously suffered in this violence, maybe children or people who have seen their loved ones killed in front of them, have suffered injury themselves, maybe their business or their house has been burnt down, they're now homeless, they need accommodation, but most of all they probably need prayer and trauma counselling. So one of our partners in Nigeria looks after that side of things, and there is a great need, there is a backlog for helping people with trauma counselling. So our appeal is really for funds to be able to allow that to happen so that those people who have been affected can get some treatment and help. And we know that it does make a difference, that it does restore people psychologically and spiritually.
You mentioned a partner in Nigeria. Does that mean you have partners in various spots around the world where people are coping with this kind of problem?
What we do is we work generally through partners on the ground in these countries because, A, they know what the situation is like. They know the best way of getting aid and funds to those who most need it. So that's what we tend to do. In Nigeria, they're very much based in the local community, part of the society. They know exactly what's going on and how to make sure that those who really need the support get it.
Also on your webpage, I notice your interest is very wide-ranging across the globe, and I see a particular campaign delivered to the North Korean embassy. Is that another area in which you have a particular concern?
We are very concerned about the situation in North Korea. Last year, we ran a campaign really calling for religious freedom in North Korea. North Korea is known as the Hermit Kingdom, and it's quite well sealed off from the rest of the world. But we're very concerned, really, about the situation for Christians in that country. Many are in what are, in effect, concentration camps, and life is incredibly difficult. Christians can be arrested just for owning a Bible, or if a member of their family is a Christian, then up to three generations of that family can be imprisoned. It doesn't always happen, but it has happened. And we know that Christians are under that pressure, as well as the pressure that the whole of North Korean society faces, living under a dictatorship. And obviously, at the moment, there is a real food crisis as well. Lots of people are starving. So from that point of view, that country is in a very difficult situation. But our campaign last year, which culminated in January when we handed in a petition of just over 50,000 names to the North Korean embassy in London calling for religious freedom, we hope that will speak to the authorities and actually help to bring about change. We also handed in the copy to Downing Street, and really we want to urge the British government to, whenever it can, to really press for change in North Korea. We believe that that can happen, and we would urge countries throughout the world who have an influence there to, whenever they can, is to bring up the issue of human rights in North Korea.
Do you find that the British government in this case is actually sensitive to your requests?
I certainly hope so. We know that they are concerned about human rights, and that human rights is an issue that is brought up when dealing with authorities from other countries. So we feel that is an issue that, you know, we often hear William Hague or David Cameron talking about human rights in relation to how another country operates in, and also in terms of giving aid to those countries. The whole issue of human rights is on the agenda. So we do urge them really to take seriously what happens to Christians, not just in North Korea, but around the world. Christians are often being oppressed, and yet their rights are never really brought onto the agenda. So what we would say, look, you know, they're human beings as well. They have human rights. You know, if you're concerned about human rights, then put this on the agenda when you're dealing with countries such as North Korea. Obviously, North Korea is quite unusual, being a sort of sealed dictatorship, but you know, situations can change very quickly. And so where there is an opportunity, please take advantage of that and press for human rights for Christians.
Well, I think the death of Kim Jong-il recently really opened a window on what life is like in North Korea. And I think a lot of people were suddenly jolted into the realization that that kind of situation does still exist in 2012.
Yeah, it's. I think because it's on the other side of the world, we tend to overlook it. And it's a small nation, and we sort of tend to dismiss it as being a bit of a tin pot dictatorship. But for people who are actually living there, it's a horrendous life, and it has been for a long, long time. I believe that the army in North Korea has actually lowered the height levels for people entering the military so that it's come down now. Because of the malnutrition, of course, North Koreans are not very tall. And so in order to get enough people into the army, they're having to lower the height levels. So it just shows, really, the impact that is having over the years.
Another area that is in the spotlight is Pakistan, of course. Is Pakistan in your range as well?
Yes, we have partners in Pakistan who look after Christians in that country. Pakistan is unusual in that there are, if you like, two areas of concern. Firstly, Christians who are from a Christian community, they can often come under pressure, but also significantly for those who want to change their religion from Islam to Christianity, they often find life very, very difficult, and they need a lot of support. So we would hope, and we've campaigned before, for there to be a change in the blasphemy laws in Pakistan. It's not just Christians who are affected by that. Muslims are, in fact, more Muslims are, but proportionately, there are more Christians who are being charged under the blasphemy laws. So it does affect them to a greater extent. And it's often used to settle personal grievances, or business problems. So it actually has nothing really to do with blasphemy, but it's used as a way of getting at Christians. So we hope and we pray and we urge the Pakistan authorities as well to repeal the blasphemy laws and actually to protect the minorities, because that's a significant problem, really.
On a positive note, Matt, it seems to me that persecution of people of other faiths goes back a long, long time. But suddenly there is a lot more talk about it. The Pope himself, at the beginning of the year, during his State of the World address, specifically spoke of the need for religious freedom. Do you find there is a changing attitude or an increasing awareness?
I think there is an increasing awareness of persecution of Christians, but I tend to fear that is actually just among the Christian community, that the world itself is not really that concerned, given that there are so many problems throughout the world at the moment. It's probably not high on most people's agenda. But I think it is significant, and I think it needs to be raised by Christians wherever we can. Obviously, you mentioned the Pope's address, and other Christian leaders as well need to speak up to make the world aware of what is going on. You know, Jesus said that they persecuted him and they will persecute us. So in a sense, we're not surprised, and it's not as though it should take us by surprise. But I think it's really within our responsibility to actually to serve and to help those who are being persecuted, to stand with them, to do everything that we possibly can to improve their situations, to just strengthen them as they're going through persecution. I think that's one of the things that at Release we feel very strongly about, is that we want the Christian community in the UK and Ireland to, you know, to engage with this issue seriously and to support their brothers and sisters in Christ.
You're absolutely right. There are millions of people across the world who every day of their lives have to face difficulty because of their different view of life and of religion. Can I ask you about Release International? You are a Christian organization. Are you ecumenical? Who exactly founded Release?
Release was founded in 1968 by a Romanian pastor called Richard Wurmbrand, who was imprisoned under the communists in the 1950s and 60s. He actually died in 2001, but he spent a total of 14 years in prison, three of which were in solitary confinement. And when he came out of Romania, he traveled the world and basically set up organizations such as Release to really make the world aware of the plight of Christians, in this case in the communist world, but obviously that has changed over the years, as well as setting up these ministries, if you like, around the world. He also testified before the US Senate about what had happened to him. And so it was a case of, and still we try to highlight the whole issue of persecution of Christians. That is still, it's changed, but you know, it's changed from country to country, but it's still a huge issue. But as well as informing the world, if you like, we're also there to support those people who are being persecuted because of their faith. We have various sister ministries around the world, so it's not just us based in the UK, but we our supporter bases in the UK and Ireland.
Are you ecumenical? Can anyone join?
Anybody can join us. Yes, that's fine. We have supporters from different denominations. We're faith based, and we have support from churches up and down the UK and Ireland. So yes, I mean, if anybody is interested in the work that we do and wants to be involved, we're more than happy to hear from anybody.
Last week, men and women across the world celebrated International Women's Day. This annual occurrence, which is marked on March the 8th, and has been so since the beginning of the 20th century, is a day when women are recognized for their achievements, without regard to divisions, whether national, ethnic, linguistic, cultural, economic, or political. It's an occasion for looking back on past struggles and accomplishments, and more importantly, for looking ahead to the untapped potential and opportunities that await future generations of women. This year, for International Women's Day, I chose to focus on the message of an organisation called HelpAge International that calls for urgent action to help millions of older women who, it says, are the invisible backbone of communities, families and food production. I discovered that HelpAge International is in fact the only global organisation with a singular focus on providing assistance to and advocating for disadvantaged older people. And this year it has been selected to receive the 2012 Conrad N. Hilton Humanitarian Prize of $1.5 million for its work in alleviating human suffering. Richard Blewett is the Chief Executive Officer of HelpAge International.
HelpAge International, it's a global network working in around 70 countries around the world, mainly in developing countries and emerging economies. essentially there to support and strengthen the rights of older people in terms of meeting their basic needs around healthcare, income security, human rights, and then also we respond in disasters to make sure that the basic needs of older people are met in disaster contexts.
I think you are the only NGO with this very singular focus on elderly people, aren't you?
We are the only NGO, and it's an awesome responsibility to have that upon us. We have, you know, over 700 million people in the world over 60 now. We will have 2 billion by about 2045, most of them in developing countries. And I think the challenge is for those developing countries to try and find ways to leapfrog and learn from what's happened in the more developed world to make sure that there's some basic health care for older people, to try and keep them healthy, make sure that they have some level of income security as the family structures change, and make sure that they're included and part of sort of successful societies and communities of tomorrow. Because one thing's sure, as the world has been developing, aging has been happening in quite a dramatic way around the world.
Now, today it's the 8th of March, and you have been awarded this large prize, the Hilton Humanitarian Prize, which I understand is the world's largest humanitarian prize for your work, and specifically for your work with millions of older women. Why are older women the invisible backbone, as your release says, of communities, families and food production?
Just what we find is older people generally, older men and women largely, are invisible or are becoming more invisible as societies change and as, you know, a lack of action is taken to put in place good policies to enable them to remain active and participative in their communities and in their societies. But particularly older women is a big issue. I mean, there's just been a UN global conference on rural women occurring in New York, and you can't find reference to older women in the whole conference, which is absolutely crazy, because it's almost as if once you become an older woman, you're not a woman anymore. And it's partly the question of where is the data to actually show what's happening. It's partly, I think, people are very age blind. But actually, the consequences are very severe. So we see, for instance, in the context of HIV and AIDS, that around half of the world's AIDS orphans are cared for by their grandmothers or a few grandfathers, but mainly grandmothers. And actually, the challenge we've faced is how do we get the mainstream actors that respond to the HIV/AIDS pandemic to make sure that they can protect these older people, to protect children. So that whole question of the bonds and support across the generations, and then getting some action done. And then in the context of farming, you know, the message we're giving out today on the International Day of Women is actually many farmers around the world are aging. And there are two big challenges there. One is how do you get young people interested in farming so that actually all these smallholders don't continue to age? Otherwise, you're going to face a major food security crisis in many countries around the world. But secondly, how do you actually anyhow enable older farmers to actually continue to farm when they face some of the medical challenges that we all face when you enter old age? And particularly if you enter old age in poverty, you're much more likely to enter old age with a chronic illness. And so, you know, and yet you still have to farm and you still have to make your, you know, meet your basic needs. Around the world, only 1 in 5 older people have a pension. So, you know, the vast majority, 80% of people, have no access to social security. And that's a huge challenge, you know, as they continue to try and remain productive, and yet they face some of the challenges that do face older people linked to non-communicable diseases.
The fact that the lifespan of the whole population is getting longer and women have a longer lifespan means that women actually do make up the majority of older people around the world. And it's something, you're right, that people don't normally think about. I would like to think that my old age is made of a well-earned rest, but that's not so for, I'd say, the majority of people across the globe, right?
No, that's correct. And I think, you know, it's important. There'll be a big attention today in the world on things like reproductive health for women, which is a really crucial thing. And we are definitely argue for a life course perspective. You know, we want to people to enter their old age in good health and, you know, have benefited from a society that takes care of our health throughout our life course. But the reality is many older people in poor developing countries, particularly older women, enter old age in bad health, partly because they've had many children with very poor care and support when they've had those children. So they have challenges to do with controlling their ability for when they need to go to the toilet. They have a whole set of medical challenges linked to the nature of what's happened in their reproductive life. And that's a huge thing that needs to be paid attention to and not seen as relevant, as we're trying to obviously focus on, you know, younger women. I think the other thing I wanted to say on the radio was it's really important. One of our key partners has been a faith-based organizations, you know, particularly actually around the world. The Catholic Church is embedded into communities that face poverty on a daily basis. And many of our partners that have worked hard to address the issues of aging actually are nuns and priests on the front line, working in slums in Nairobi or working, trying to run older people's homes in Colombia in the conflict zones. So I particularly would like to pay testament to them, those frontline people who are working to empower and support older people in very, very difficult circumstances.
In April, you will, in fact, be receiving this award. It's $1.5 million. Where will you be directing these funds? Which are your major areas of concern?
Well, we want to direct them in places where they're going to make a biggest impact. So one area is continuing to build the strength of the network and the voice of older people to advocate for the change they need and deserve. So resources in building the movement of older people around the world to be able to stand up for their rights and secure them. The second area we're going to invest in is healthcare. You know, it's not good enough that if you're in a developing country and you've got a disease related to old age, like the risk of having a stroke, or you've got, you know, very sore bones linked to arthritis. You know, there are intervention strategies that could make a real big difference to the quality of your life and the way you can keep contributing in your families. And we want attention paid to that area of public health and more action done. You know, I've seen in Congo older women with diabetes in pain because they can't afford the $5 of treatment. And so, you know, there are solutions, and we've got to make sure that those are better access to older people in challenging circumstances. So those are priorities for us. And then lastly, what we want to do is lever the international attention to this challenge and try and bring others towards working with us in collaboration and in partnership, because, you know, there are probably 400 NGOs around the world working on children's issues, and some of those NGOs are probably 10 times the size we are, even one of them. And why is it we've only got one on aging? And I think that that's a big challenge and opportunity for us. How can we find a way to get the foundations and those that invest in trying to bring about good positive change to realize that this global mega trend of aging is a great success of development, but now we've got to invest in it to make sure that all parts of the community can actually move ahead and succeed in their lives. We frame that, we call it the longevity dividend. The countries that are going to succeed for tomorrow are ones that actually value age and can see older people as relevant economic stakeholders, political stakeholders, and social stakeholders. Those that marginalize them, they're going to be the societies of yesterday.
That's all from the English feature program and from me, Linda Bordoni, today. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.